Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio. Hi, and welcome to the Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Thursday, November the 24th, 2022. Happy Thanksgiving. Dr. Tim is off with family, and so we're doing a pre-recorded show, and this is his interview with Pierre Pradervan. Enjoy. We'll see you in an hour.
Hello, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. This is your host, Tim Hayes, for today, Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. And I'm here with Pierre Pradervan, all the way from Switzerland, and it's just an absolute honor to be able to have him on Mind Shifters Radio. Pierre, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hello, Tim. It's a great joy for me to be with you all. Really a joy.
Well, it's more than a joy. I'm actually vibrating. I've been reading your books for years, and I'm so thrilled to have you on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
I would love to. I would love to because it's also a deep experience of forgiveness. In the 80s, I was working for a group of Swiss NGOs involved in international development issues, and I'd been asked to start a program on North-South issues for Swiss schools. And I loved my job, and I so loved it that I had a camp bed in my office, and when I missed the last train, I used to sleep at the office. And at one moment, I wanted to do a roving exhibit on hunger for the schools, which is one of the world's main problems. Today, still 800 million people go to bed hungry every night. And there was no money in the budget, and my sponsor said, sorry, Pierre, you can't do it. We don't have the money. So I took out of my personal account, at the time, the equivalent of about $15,000, which today would be, in buying power, at least $25,000 to $30,000, out of my personal savings, and organized this roving exhibit, which had a great success. And at the time, I became member of the World Hunger Project, which started in the United States, which was also a campaign to end hunger. And it had the motto, "The End of Hunger for the year 2000. And I also spoke of this in my work in the schools, and my sponsors didn't like this organization at this campaign at all, maybe because they were a bit leftist and it came from the United States, and forbid me to talk about it. I found that very amazing, but I accepted. But I continued using the slogan, "The End of Hunger for the year 2000, because I've worked in Africa. I was one of the founding members of a grassroots peasant organization in the Sahel, which became the largest of its kind in the whole of Africa, with hundreds of thousands of grassroots peasants as members. And one of our organizations, grassroots organizations, had the same motto, "The End of Hunger for the year 2000. So I thought, well, if it's good for the African farmers, it's good for my work. And there was one man in these organizations who literally hated my guts. He wanted to get rid of me. And so he convened a business meeting of the four organizations and me. There were no minutes taken, nothing. It was strictly illegal. And I was told, either you quit saying we can end hunger by the year 2000, or you quit your job. Here are four organizations fighting hunger telling me not to speak about the end of hunger, whereas my earlier exhibit on hunger had been called Ending Hunger Today, and they had applauded it. So I left, but I developed such terrible resentment, which was killing me, literally. It became an absolute obsession. I thought of it from morning to evening. And I knew I was harming myself, Tim. I knew that, but sometimes these aggressive thoughts, very difficult to shake them off. And then one day, just reading the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' simple statement, bless those who curse you. But of course, Pierre, it's so simple. You just need to bless them. And on the spot, Tim, I just started blessing them in their joy, in their peace, in their health, in their finances, in their family relationships, in every imaginable way. And a few months later, suddenly, I started blessing people in the street, the post office, in the supermarket. And I used to take the train quite a lot. And I used to walk the whole length of the train from one end to the other twice to be sure to bless every single person on that train. And then one day I was preparing a talk for an international meeting, youth meeting in Zurich, on the theme healing the world. And suddenly I received this immense gust of inspiration. And literally, I was literally like a scribe under orders. The text, The Gentle Art of Blessing, which is on our website, was literally dictated to me. The website, by the way, is www.gentleartofblessing.org. All linked, gentleartofblessing.org. And you will see on the homepage a fabulous video of this text made by our webmaster, Jane. And I started sending this text out in my letters. And little by little, I started getting amazing responses from people everywhere saying, it works, it works, it works. And I myself started having very powerful experiences using this blessing and completely reversing difficult situations, sometimes in a matter of seconds, just by blessing the people with a pure, heartfelt intent. Because blessing, as I explain it in my text, has nothing to do with the traditional liturgical form of blessing in churches. It's sending love energy from the heart to another person. So it is 100% heart energy. I'm sure many of you Americans know about the HeartMath Institute in California, which is a wonderful research institute on the functioning of the heart, not the physiological functioning, but the social and psychological and spiritual functioning. And they say that heart energy is 5,000 times more powerful than the energy of the mind. And I repeat, blessing is completely and totally heart energy. And I've been getting now for 30 years responses from all around the world. People will find many on the section on our website on healing. There's a whole section on healing through blessing. Even one of my favorite healings on that website is that of the head of a supermarket, large supermarket in Switzerland, who had a very severe case of depression. And he was sent to clinic, had the classical treatment, was pumped up with drugs of all sorts, and slowly came out of his depression, still on rather shaky legs, and started work again. And soon he felt depression coming back. And he was absolutely in despair. And he took made an appointment with his psychiatrist. And this is one of the most beautiful stories I know of. This gentleman told him, look, Mr. Ullmann, I'm not going to give you any more drugs. Here's what I recommend to you. And he gave him my book on the gentle art of blessing. and the book by Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. And I received this amazing letter from this gentleman saying how his whole life had been just literally transformed by blessing, that it pulled him out completely out of his depression, and that he had so many opportunities every day as a head of a supermarket to bless people. So do you have maybe a comment or a question, Tim?
What else is most important from your experience for having good results?
Well, I would really come back to, number one, sincerity. Mary Baker Eddy, who was an American metaphysician of the 19th century, once made a statement that has been a guiding star in my life. A deep sincerity is sure of success, for God takes care of it. I think that is the first quality, and then the others. I would put now I put motivation and intention together, which is the same quality of thought. But sincerity is very, very important, and of course perseverance, as you said. I can't think of a single area of life where this is not necessary. Speaking of demonstrations, I had last Saturday, just a few days ago, I had a workshop on spiritual healing. And in this workshop, I speak, of course, about blessing. And there was a lawyer, a lovely woman, who had a difficult work situation she was working on. And over lunchtime, she took a moment to herself and started blessing the whole situation. Half an hour later, before we started the afternoon session, the person involved phoned her to say the problem was solved. And we started the afternoon with this person telling this story. And you can imagine the incredible impact it had on the whole group. Here was someone amongst them who was proving that what we were talking about works. That was so, so lovely. Now, I more and more also, I feel that a deep, lasting compassion is fundamental, not only to blessing, but to anything. But I've been blessing now for a good 30 years, Tim, and I cannot see any form of suffering, any, without immediately blessing the person or the situation involved. I don't have to think about it. The minute I see suffering, sometimes it's just a glance in somebody's eyes, an air of suffering or despair, and to immediately have this fabulous tool, this fabulous approach to be able to support them is wonderful.
And so how would you, for those of us, and there are many who listening who haven't yet read the books, how would you turn an experience of seeing someone who is suffering and you see the suffering in their eyes? What might come to mind for you to turn that into a blessing for them? What would it look like to bless someone?
As I say in the text on blessing, the one-page text that you'll find on the website in the form of video, you always reverse the material picture. If you see a drunkard shouting and screaming in the bus or in the street, I immediately bless him in his serenity, his peace, his joy. As smokers, wherever I am in the world, as soon as I see a smoker, I bless them in their deep contentment. Because to smoke a weed that is polluting your body, well, probably there isn't a very deep contentment there. Or when I see someone who's evidently deeply depressed, I bless them in their serenity, their oneness with the source, their deep peace, their quiet joy. And sometimes it can go, I remember a woman I saw in Geneva some years ago who was evidently depressed. And for 2 months, I continued blessing this woman because I just felt that was a thing to do. But to be maybe concrete, would it be okay if I read three blessings from my book, 365 Days?
Oh, it would be wonderful.
365 blessings?
Sure.
Okay. So, you know, there are 365 topics, so I'll take three very different ones. The first one is for child soldiers. Child soldiers, that is to say, any children under the age of 18, and sometimes they can be as young as 6, 7, 8 years old, who are used as fighters, cooks, suicide bombers, human shield, messengers, spies, or for sexual purposes. And in the last 15 years, the use of child soldiers has spread to almost every region in the world, every armed conflict, and many armed conflicts. It's impossible ever to make a statistics, but there's certainly many, many thousands of child soldiers serving illegally, and I would guess tens of thousands. So here is this blessing for child soldiers on page 223 of the book. From our heart of hearts, we bless children who are abducted and forced to serve in armed conflict. We bless them in their innocence, that despite the trying and sometimes dramatic situations they are in, deep down inside them, the consciousness of this innocence stays awake. We bless them in their fundamental integrity, that the horrendous things they are forced to witness and often to accomplish may not erase their desire to escape from the human hell they have been forced into, or their belief in another more humane and normal life, and the possibility of one day achieving it. We bless them in their consciousness of their oneness with you and their essentially perfect divine identity. When they walk through Death Canyon, may your hand keep them safe from all evil, both from performing it or being its victim. When solitude, hunger, sheer despair, or the desire to give up on life cruelly grips them, may the comforting presence of grace support them and lift them up. And finally, we bless the adults who so uncaringly force children who could be their own into such situations, that your spirit may awaken them to their true nature as children of God. And another one is on someone considering suicide. I saw recently in the newspaper that there was a great increase of suicides in the United States, and that is also in my country, Switzerland. There's also an epidemic of that kind of behavior. And all around the world, in the so-called more developed countries, there are just waves of suicide. And our hearts can only go out to them with the most immense compassion and tenderness, which is what we will do now, reading this blessing. We extend our love and burning compassion to the thousands all around the planet who are considering at this very moment taking their own lives. We bless them from the depths of our soul, that they may, by some miracle, i.e. the normal functioning of grace, be touched by some event, experience, feeling which puts an end to their somber plans or halts their unpremeditated, self-destructive impulse. May the magic of grace break through all the darkness in their heart, that they somehow feel the unconditional caring of the Source, capital S, for their good and their wholeness, yea, even their deep happiness. Despite all the self-loathing and self-condemnation, or simply their utter and total despair, may they feel infinite love has already forgiven in advance everything and anything they could ever do. We bless them that they may understand that the lessons they might be avoiding here on earth will have to be learned in another realm or another incarnation, and that these lessons are solely for their good, however tough they seem to be, and some are admittedly horrendously challenging. We bless those that surround them, so they may find just the right words to turn them around and invoke in them that glimmer of hope that makes all the difference. And if they have made a failed attempt at taking their own life, may they be received not with condemnation or frown, but with open arms and hearts and loving faces and words that evoke in them the desire to live a full and useful life. And the third one, I've noticed, you know, I've been doing workshops on personal development for 27 years now, and I've become in different countries, including the United States, and I've become aware of how few people really love themselves, how few people are capable of showing authentic kindness and caring for themselves. And I think it is difficult to give to the world something one has not given to oneself. So here is a brief blessing on developing infinite kindness towards myself. There's a psalm that says, I praise you that I am such a wonderful creature. Is that being, that creature, not worthy total kindness and caring? So here is the blessing. I bless myself in my ability to express infinite kindness to the child of the universe I am. May I unhesitatingly express to myself the kindness I am so willing to extend to others. When I stumble or fall, may I grant myself a tender word of kindness rather than a harsh reprimand. When I procrastinate, play tricks with myself, or knowingly avoid a needed challenge, may I allow myself to become aware of the harm I'm doing myself rather than knocking myself around angry words. When I'm struggle-weary and feel like giving up the fight, may I allow myself to rest in your green pastures rather than hitting myself on the head or whipping myself along. And finally, may I always be aware of the barrier between the deceitful hammock of self-indulgence and the true wisdom of authentic kindness towards myself, remembering your words spoken through a great spiritual seer. This is my beloved child, in whom I am well pleased. A statement that applies to every single one of us on the planet and other planets too. There we are.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, that's a wonderful answer to my question. How would you bless someone who's suffering? If you can develop that kind of reverse image for the picture your senses or your eyes are showing you, and then just pour your heart energy into it. I had the one of the things highlighted to talk to you about was in day 310 of your blessings. There was a woman who was giving a testimonial about how she refused to judge, and her name is Claudine. And your comment after it was, "Dear Claudine, it worked for you because there exist spiritual laws that are as rigorous and certain as those of physics, if one knows how to activate them. However, they have to be felt on the level of the heart and not on the mental level. The mental level is the level on which most Westerners function 90% of the time. But when it's felt, deeply felt on the level of the heart, in such cases, the result is often instantaneous." So, applaud your coming back over and over again to the idea of the heart energy, to the idea of these natural laws, spiritual laws, and learning to work with existing natural law. This is one of the things that Dr. Michael Rice works so diligently on in his presentations. And he talks about how we don't break spiritual laws. We either learn to work with them or we get broken. We have unpleasant results if we don't learn, pour energy into a situation of anger. All I'm going to get back from it is more of what I've poured into it. And one of the keys to how this works so well for me is in reading your books over and over again, and in these lovely examples and testimonials of blessing, it brings to mind, it's like I develop a kind of a muscle memory for moving into that positive response and away from the conditioned negative response that was, you know, so deeply programmed into me.
Tim, I'd like
another
to say,
thing. Go right ahead.
No, go finish what you say.
Well, I was just going to say there's another thing I wanted to bring up, which is woven through your 365 blessings are blessings from so many wonderful divergent resources, whether it's Jewish or Native American or Hindu. And I found in several of your Native American blessings a blessing that I stumbled across as a senior in high school and put on a banner. And it was the saying from a Native American anthology at the time, "I seek strength not to be better than my brother, but to fight my greatest enemy, myself." And I mentioned that I found that, I mentioned on the internet show in the past, that I found that in one of your blessings. And by the time I finished the book, that phrase is part of several Native American blessings mentioned in your book.
Yes.
So it's a way of feeling like I'm coming home when I read your book.
That's lovely. I have such admiration for the American Indian culture, Native American culture. And I think these people who were treated like savages and pagans for so long have such a lot to teach us. Now, especially with the revival of the environmental movement and the need to save the planet, these people are our teachers. And I insist on that because they've always had an awe, a respect of nature, which is so extraordinary. I think I saw a film just a few days ago on Brazil, and where they have huge areas that have been deforested for planting soya and other plants. And there was this big landowner standing in front of his fields that went so far you could see nothing else. And he said, "Before we came, there was nothing here. And now look at it. And it's just the reversal. They have killed an incredible life of trees and plants and animals, and now they're just these stalks of soya, which are impoverishing the soil, being poisoned with pesticides. And that's, we need great humility to learn from the first peoples of the planet in other areas, also in Africa, where I lived many years. We have such a lot to learn, but especially the Native American culture is so incredibly rich, such a gift to humanity, and I hope we will be wise enough to really listen to what they have to tell us. That's one of my favorite stories. Thank you for mentioning, asking me to share it, Tim. Well, I was, at that time, I was a member of a spiritual movement that had the pretension of being the ultimate revelation of truth, something terribly heavy to carry. And we had a textbook, and in that textbook there was a definition of God in a few lines. And of course for me that was the ultimate truth, the ultimate definition of God you could ever find. And I was really stuck in my incredible self-righteousness. And I lived at that time in a little bungalow between two shanty towns in Dakar, literally between two shanty. They were about 100 and 150 yards from my little bungalow. And occasionally I'd invite the young people from one of the shanty towns to come and have a drink tea on Moroccan tea on the Saturday afternoon, that Moroccan tea, which is absolutely delicious, served with mint. And among the young boys, there was the son of the local imam in one of the two shanty towns. A very soft-spoken, kind gentleman, Imam Sal, S-A-L-L, was his name. And occasionally I'd go and talk to him. And one Sunday I thought, I'm going to ask Imam Sal how Islam defines God. I was so cocksure. I, of course, had the best reply in the world. And as I strode along the beach to go to his home, my mind was in the frame of mind of that wonderful Japanese proverb that says it's very difficult to describe the vast horizons of the ocean to the little frog sitting at the bottom of its well. That was a perfect description of my state of mind. A little frog crouching at the bottom of this dark well of self-righteousness. And I arrived at Imam Sal's home and said the normal greetings. And then I said, well, Imam Sal, I've come to ask you how Islam defines God. And in the following minutes, the little frog at the bottom of the well had the stupor of its life. With his gentle voice, he said, you know, Pierre, if you took all the branches of all the trees in the whole world as pens, and if you took all the water over the lakes and the oceans and rivers and seas and fountains of the whole world as ink, you could not write out all the qualities, all the names of God. And in the moment of stunned stupor that followed, he said, you know, Pierre, you're a better Muslim than most Muslims who surround me. By that he meant that I didn't drink, whereas most of the Frenchmen and the Europeans working in Senegal were good wine bibbers. I didn't run after girls. I didn't even have a girlfriend, whereas most of the technical assistants, I mean all the people coming from Europe, especially mostly Frenchmen, to help in the development of Senegal, had a whole chorus of young girls running after them, hoping to one day be able to marry one guy like them. And finally, I gave generously, and Imam suggests that people practice tithing. There's a lovely poem by an American poet, I've forgotten his name, who says, he drew a circle to close me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that closed him in. I had closed Imam Sal out of my little mental world. And Imam Sal, bless him wherever he may be, drew a larger circle of kindness and acceptance that drew me. And that was one of the great lessons of my life. And of course, later I left the movement, spiritual movement to which I belonged. And now I'm not attached to any religion, church, spiritual movement of any sort. I'm what I call an independent spiritual thinker. As a matter of fact, there's a French encyclopedia on spirituality that's just come out and has classified me as a representative of lay spirituality, which sits quite well with me. So that's one of my favorite stories.
Well, and you tell it beautifully. Thank you. It's moving. It's far better than reading. I'll hear your voice now when I reread that story. Delightful.
I love telling stories. Maybe I can add to that, that the gentle art of blessing, the practice of blessing, as I explain it in my book. And again, I insist that it's completely different from the very liturgical, automatic thing one often does in churches, is that this practice has been tested from Death Row, Texas, where my friend Roger McGowan, at one moment on death row, going through a horrendously challenging situation, I sent him the chapters of my book in English, chapter after chapter, and he received the first chapter, and the practice just turned his life around. But I also have a wonderful Muslim friend in Mali, in Senegal, Mali in the Sahel. Mali is a country to the east of Senegal, and a large country locked in the Sahel. He's a wonderful, devout Muslim, Mamoudou Kassambara, and he just adopted blessing like no one I've ever encountered, I think, still more than myself, to the extent that he founded an NGO, a small voluntary organization, which works with the poorest of the poor in the world, the peasant farmers of the Sahel. And he got so excited with this practice that he started teaching it in the villages. And when they had a problem, they just, a small group of 15, 20 maybe, farmers and their wives, and they would just start blessing the situation. So it's been tested in all kinds of situations, including in prisons in Geneva. I was for 18 years a prison visitor in Geneva. And I especially visited English-speaking African inmates because I speak English fluently and I'm familiar with the African culture and British culture. And I remember one day this Ghanaian gentleman arrived, and he'd been in prison for some drug traffic. He was in a desperate situation. His mother was very ill in Ghana, where there, of course, there's no health insurance. And he really had to urgently find funds to be able to help her. And a friend told him, look, you just carry a suitcase with drugs in the double bottom of your suitcase, and you can earn $5,000 just for one trip. Well, that solved all his problems, he thought. And so he did his trip, but evidently he was terribly naive. And the dogs at the frontier control sniffed the drugs immediately, and off he was whisked to prison. And that's where I met him. And I gave him my book on Plessy in English, and he just lapped it up. And Tim, he started blessing people left and right and making it a 24-hour, or at least a 15-hour occupation. He blessed the guards, of course, the other inmates, the people in the kitchen, all the people serving the prison. He blessed the district attorney, the judge, his lawyer, and he just blessed. And normally the prison sentence for something like this would have been at least 7-8 years. And he just spent his time blessing the whole court, and he was only given a year and a half. No one could believe it when he came back to the prison. And as he'd spent about already 1 year incarcerated, he only had a few months to serve and then left for his country. So there's so many of these kinds of stories, Tim, over a 30-year span, that I'll stop now. I'll let you ask a question or two.
Well, it's just wonderful. I have thoughts in my head. We've been doing this radio show long enough, and people call with responses. I've been doing support groups for years, and people have responses, and some of those are echoing in my head. I know sometimes people come up with, yeah, but you can't bless somebody who just did this horrible thing or that horrible thing. And you address that fairly well in your blessing for day 138. You say, a blessing for life, quote, approval may not be the appropriate response in a given situation. Blessing is always appropriate. And I just love the idea that you've separated out the art of blessing, the act of blessing from a heartfelt space of sending loving energy into the situation, even when it's a horrible situation, and making it clear that that's not saying I approve of this situation. You go on to say, to fully face reality, you have to say yes. This is the yes of blessing. It's not necessarily the yes of approval. And then to go along with what you were talking about, this gentleman that you think took blessing to a whole new level, you say in the book that your very favorite blessing story is a testimony. And it came just a year after the first French version of your book, The Gentle Art of Blessing, came out. And you read about this nurse, a retired nurse, Frida. Do you remember that story?
Oh, absolutely. It's just so extraordinary. This woman was partially invalidated. She came to the main Zurich station, which is the largest train station in the whole of Switzerland. Every morning she'd come there, and she would spend, on the website there's a very brief video of this woman. She'd spend the whole day standing, resting on her wheelchair, occasionally sitting down for brief moments, and blessing. She continued till 9-10 at night, and she must have spent at least 10 years doing this blessing. There was a major article in one of the Zurich newspapers on her, which I cut out. That's how I discovered her existence. And she must have spent, blessed at least millions of people, I mean over 10 years, doing this about at least 10 to 12 hours per day. And she lived in a retirement home, and one day she passed on. But it's my favorite blessing story, because the level of commitment and dedication of this woman to do this 6 days a week for years and years and years and years is just something phenomenal.
Yes, and so is your work And I must tell you that in doing this interview with you and being able to share this time with you, my heart is covered with honey.
Thank you. Let me explain that expression. Among the Moba of North Togo, which the tribe of North Togo, there was a custom now, like all these wonderful old customs, it's practically disappeared. But when you met someone and you asked them, how are you today? And if the person felt really well, they would say, my heart is covered with honey. As a matter of fact, I have a very dear friend who had some artist draw up a picture of a heart with a few bees on it, just overflowing and dripping honey. So, yes, that's such a lovely expression. And if you start blessing, and if you continue blessing with perseverance, your soul, your heart will be covered with honey. That's a promise I make to you.
It is. It is truly, it has been my experience. And I don't have words for my gratitude for your willingness to share this with us. We have about 6 minutes left before the second hour of our show starts. And Dr. Michael Rice and his wife Jeannie will host the next hour of this show. Dr. Michael Rice earlier texted me and said, make sure that you let Pierre know if he's got the time and energy and wants to continue the conversation for a while. He'd be happy to do that. I mention this because earlier on, Dr. Rice had his hand up as though he was available to speak and say hello. So, Michael, as I scan down the callers, I don't see you there. So if you're on, if you'd press 1, we have quite a few callers on the line. So and Jeannie.
And there's one last thing I would like to share after Dr. Michael Rice has intervened and anybody else. One last thing after the others.
Okay. Well, I'd love to have you share that now. I don't want to, miss
okay.
the opportunity because he's not sharing. He's not raising his hand right now. So please go ahead.
Well, we live in a very turbulent world where we label people very easily. And as I say in the text on blessing, it's impossible to judge and to bless at the same time. Every morning, I spend about half an hour blessing different people, and I include President Trump, President Putin of Russia, President Bolsonaro of Brazil, who seems to be destroying the forests of his country, and President Assad of Syria, whom many have described as the greatest criminal of the century, and President Kim of North Korea. And I bless them, and I really bless them from the soul. And I can really say to them, even out loud, I love you and I bless you. I love you, my brother. And that is what blessing does to you. It transforms you at a deep inner level. And you can absolutely no longer judge, because you understand, and that's one of the greatest breakthroughs I've made in years, that everyone is at every moment at the highest level of consciousness. And my very last sharing is something I've started doing in the past year only. When I bless, I spend my time blessing people in public transport. As I don't have a car, I circulate by bus, tram, train a lot. And I've started blessing people silently, of course, always silently. And I start the blessing by saying, I love you and I bless you in your divine identity. And I really look at them. And to say with sincerity to someone you don't know at all, I love you, well, it demands a great deal of you. And it's one of the most demanding and wonderful spiritual discipline I have ever encountered. I love you and I bless you in your divine identity.
Well, yes, and I love that you so well in your book, and you talk about the need to see past the veil or the disguise of perception that our senses give us to this deeper connectedness of all things, this one mind, this divine energy. And we speak of that so often in this work on Mind Shifters Radio and with the tools that Dr. Michael Rice makes available. He's a director of a foundation charged with translating the oldest known copy of the New Testament directly from the ancient Aramaic into English. Well, Pierre, I want to make sure that before we close out this portion of the show, we let people know the best way to access your material other than through your books, The Gentle Art of Blessing and 365 Blessings to Heal Myself and the World. What website would you direct people to most?
Well, for anything concerned with spirituality, thegentleartofblessing.org website is the best. Now, I also have a website just on my books, bilingual English and French. The address is pierrepredivan.com, or link pierrepredivan.com. Those who are interested in going into looking in it, into the books, especially the book by Roger McGowan, Messages of Life from Death Row, which has also transformed numerous lives all around the world. This book has had an incredible, I remember one woman in Switzerland, she read the book, she just made a modest inheritance, and she'd sent me $50,000 just from reading a book. Well, you can imagine the impact that book must have had for her.
More than just a simple blessing to have you share with us, and my heart is covered with honey.
Thank you. Thank you. And mine is too. And mine is too. I mean, there are few greater joys for me in life than to be able to share this practice, which I know heals at a deep, deep level and gives such great joy. So thank you, friends, and God bless you, and speak to you another time.
So that was a pre-recorded interview with Dr. Tim and Pierre Predivan, and hope you enjoyed that. And we want to welcome you to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. We're beginning a little bit early since that completed a little early. Today is Thanksgiving Day, and it is Thursday, November the 24th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1 if you wish to talk to us. What we're going to do today is I am going to read something that I wrote, and I've read it every year, adding to it and editing it for the things that have changed. And then Michael's going to talk for a little bit, and then we are going to do the last 33 minutes as a pre-recorded show. So if you have something you want to say or share, you want to share a blessing or something you're grateful for, now would be the time to do that. Welcome, Michael. And we have no hand up, so I'm going to, yeah.
Great. Well, let's say hello to the hand.
No, I said we do not have a hand up.
Oh, okay. Well, then, so, why don't you share your Thanksgiving reading? Well, you know, we're here to just a wonderful interview, Dr. Tim, and the opening to that gentle art of blessing, and here we are with Thanksgiving. And I love that statement Dr. Tim made right at the end there, that his heart was covered in honey. And that's kind of what it feels like to tap into that energy on still another level and to be in appreciation. I think that appreciation is another faculty of being. And when we tap in, just like when we cultivate the relationship with love, we cultivate compassion, cultivating gratitude and appreciation is bringing in deeper and deeper ways the true essence of our being into a form that perhaps carries something less than that and is in need of healing. So appreciation for everybody that's with us today. And Jeannie, why don't you share your blessing statement? I haven't heard it yet this year, so I'll be interesting to hear it.
All right. So this has definitely been a year of change and challenge like no other, especially with the pandemic since 2020. We have personally faced the challenges of having COVID twice now and have come through with an actual upgrade in health, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. It has given us the opportunity to process fear and anything else that was held in ourselves that did not belong there. Dad physically did not fare as well, and he's now in an assisted living as he can no longer walk. I am thankful we were able to be here in Bristol when all of this happened, and we cared for Dad as long as we could here at home for a little over 3 years. And for the past year, we've been able to be his patient advocate with the facility that he's in to make sure that he's still properly cared for, and we're close enough to visiting several times a week. Also being here in Bristol, we've been able to share in the care of our granddaughter, Aria, for the past 4 years, and she has been an awesome teacher. I am thankful that we have enough of everything we need and thankful we have been protected and taken care of and supported when things seem darkest. I am thankful to feel the presence of love and to know it is all okay and that we can walk on water in the midst of the storm. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough here. Get a drink of water there. The following I have read every year with just a few edits for the changes that have taken place. Even though I often want other things that I don't have, I am most grateful for what I do have that I sometimes take for granted. And I want to focus on the fact that I am thankful for Yahweh, God, and the love he gave to the world, and for Yeshua, Jesus, the Christ, for showing the way. I am able to freely worship in spirit and truth and honor my Creator. Thank you, God. And by the way, he is my Savior and my Lord, and there is a difference between those two. I was blessed with phenomenal parents who gave me life. Mom went on to heaven September 25th, 2017, so now I say I am thankful that I had her for as long as I did.
Breathing with you, sweetheart. That was quite a shock when she
Yep. I wish it had been longer, but she was ready to go. She wanted to go. My dad is having increasing challenges with Parkinson's and dementia since 2018. I think that was actually his checking out. But he could no longer live alone, and I'm thankful that I'm able to be here with him, as he was for me as I was growing up. I'm thankful he still remembers some things and that we can help him through the challenges. I have a son who is beyond words. He's the pride and the joy of my life. He's the answer to my prayers and is the very presence of God made manifest. I'm thankful I was able to give birth and then to have been able to watch him grow into such a fine young man. I have a lovely daughter-in-law who loves me back and supports and loves my son. Together they have been wonderful friends and partners and parents. And now I've been blessed with the most precious granddaughter, Aria Rain Shaw. From the moment I laid eyes on her, when she was just minutes on this planet, I felt my being expand. I'm thankful she is so perfect and healthy. And it's an added bonus that she is so beautiful and sweet. I'm blessed that we can keep her 2 to 3 days a week and be part of her growing, learning, and experiencing the love that she is and her reflecting that back to me as well. I have a partner, Michael, who shares life with me. We met 19 years ago this week, and we celebrate being married 17 and a half years right now. We have traveled together, done workshops and intensives together, played together, and he is presently supporting me so lovingly even to the point of rearranging his life to be here supporting me and my dad and Aria Rain. Our romantic relationship is fulfilling, and he often takes my breath away only to give it back and to remind me to breathe. He has two wonderful children and their spouses and three beautiful granddaughters, one who just arrived this year, who I am privileged to share a portion of their lives with. His family has embraced me. I wish we were all closer geographically so we could spend more time with them. I'm thankful for the time we have been able to spend with them. I have two other amazing stepsons that have been in my life for over 44 years. They call me Mom, even though I never asked them to. That is pure acceptance. Their mom has embraced me as well, and we are good friends. I have two beautiful step-grandchildren through them as well. And again, I wish we were closer geographically so as to spend more time. I was blessed with three fabulous brothers who call me Sis. They have awesome wives and kids. Some of their kids have kids. God has truly blessed this entire family. My eldest brother, only 14 months older than me, passed away July 2020, giving us all a wake-up call on how precious our time is here together. He now dances with Mom and others who have gone on. I have friends and loved ones who I know I can call at any time. And while we may not see each other that often, we remain close. I am thankful for that caring. I have a lot of people in my life that I consider friends, but more than the number of friends, I have a great number of them who are close enough to hear my heart and hold me in love even when I'm in my stuff. They hear even when there are no words spoken, and they see me. I'm thankful for my health, which is good, and my body that serves me well more times than not. I am thankful that I am not too difficult to look at. And Michael knows this story from when we met on eHarmony in November of 2003. And he asked me what, and he asked me what I looked like because I had not posted a picture. And I told him I wasn't too difficult to look at. I may not be wealthy, but I can pay my bills and live comfortably, although simply. And many people can't say that. While I attempt to be perfect, I do make mistakes, and I'm thankful for the gentle lessons given to me instead of giving me a 2x4. The trials and the challenges that give me the opportunity to forgive once more. I'm thankful for my degree in psychology. I was able to finish college in 2013. Thankful for what I learned as well as what I was able to share with my professors and fellow students. I am thankful for the potential that is now mine. I'm thankful for good air and sunshine, even for rain and snow, and clean water to drink and wholesome food to eat. I'm thankful for a bed to sleep in and a roof over my head. I am thankful for the ability to laugh and to feel safe and secure, and I am thankful I survived and learned from the times when things were not so safe and secure. I'm thankful for the vehicles we have. None of them are new, but they serve the purpose very well. I'm thankful for the time to see and do all that we see and do. Time to share, time to love, time to be. I'm glad I have a cell phone and computer, even though electronics sometimes present challenges. I'm able to stay connected with those who I am away from more than I could without that technology. Thankful we have been able to use this technology to do workshops and intensives virtually when things shut down due to COVID. We had to stop the travel and close up Heartland, and yet we could move forward with the work. I'm thankful for experiencing love within myself and from family and friends. It's the source that we move through on this planet and what sustains us in times of challenge. The technology we have today allows us to see all over this great planet and experience things that once were not even imagined. This includes television, internet, radio, telephones, computers, but also the technology of cars and planes and trains. The opportunities we have today are immense, and I'm thankful for them. And for the shoulders we stand on, as Michael says, those who invented these things. I'm glad I know how to read and write. These are two skills that have helped me move through life more easily and have afforded me employment that otherwise I could not have gotten. I appreciate people I meet. Once strangers become new friends and support, cherished ones become dearer each time we meet. Simple things in life. Thankful for the crackle of a fire, a shooting star, the glow of the moon, the warmth of the sun, the smell of pine, the sound of laughter, the smile of a child, the beauty of mountains and valleys, rolled hay still sitting in the field, newborn calves gaining their footing, the sunset, the sunrise, the rainbow which reminds us of God's promise, for the sand on the ocean shore, the rolling waves and the salty breeze, for the falling snow that covers the trees and the ground, making all things beautiful and at peace. Thankful for family get-togethers, reunions, holidays, camping, or simply shopping and chatting. While we did not do many of these things during COVID, we still stayed connected through FaceTime calls and emails, and we joined family today for our Thanksgiving meal. Thankful to be able to express my thoughts and feelings freely, the liberty that is afforded to this country. I am thankful there are those, including my dad and three brothers, who have been willing to take a stand for this country and the people in it. I wish for the time when people awaken to do something different than war. Laughter and tears, to express without words. And more than that, I have so many people who hear the unspoken that comes from my heart and they genuinely care. I'm thankful I'm above ground one more time, thankful for the morning and the night. Conveniences of running water and indoor toilets. Although I enjoyed being at Grandma and Granddad's house when they did not have these luxuries, I'm glad that I do. I'm glad I can so easily obtain groceries and gas, and I have electric heat instead of having to build a fire. I'm glad we have fireplaces for pleasure, though. I love air conditioning in my home and car. I love to simply flip on a switch, and the room is illuminated in light. I'm thankful for the experiences at Grandma and Granddad's. I learned how to milk cows, gather eggs, put up salted meat, churn butter, haul hay, grade tobacco, make molasses, harvest and plant. Many of these skills will never be used again by me, but I'm glad that I learned them. I am thankful for the gardens that we have made here and the abundance of food that we have gotten from our own labor and from the earth. I am thankful for my mind and that it could think, remember, and figure and have discernment. I have both knowledge and wisdom. I am thankful I have all five senses. I can see, hear, feel, taste, and smell. I even have the sixth sense of intuition, which alerts me when I'm paying attention to it. I'm thankful to hear loved ones' voice, to see their sweet face, to taste country cooking, to feel the touch of a hand or lips on mine, and to smell flowers in the spring. I'm thankful for travel and seeing so many parts of this planet. And I'm thankful for home. I'm glad we have theaters, plays, bowling, skiing, hiking, biking, swimming, music, and so many other ways to entertain ourselves. And I'm thankful for the silent times when I can just meditate and just be. I'm thankful for my physician and dentist and pharmacy that they are willing to listen and do something other than medication. They are real healers. I am thankful that there are modern means of doing surgery when it's necessary. I am glad I have clothes to wear, shoes on my feet, a coat, gloves and boots in the winter, shorts and sandals in the summer. I'm glad my clothes are also stylish as well as functional. I'm thankful for my abilities, for the jobs I have had, the experiences and growth, for the money when I needed it, the ability to earn it instead of begging for a handout. The diversity in their world, the cultures that give color to the universe, all cells within one body. I'm thankful for those who have taught me and been patient in my learning along the way. My grandparents, parents, teachers, preachers, spouses, siblings, children, grandchildren, friends, and acquaintances for their time and their energy. I am thankful I can dream. I am thankful for the innocence of children to remind me who I am. I am thankful, all of me, Jeannie.
Well, I certainly breathe all that gratitude in with you. And I'm going to affirm gratitude for everything that you just shared, Jeannie. It's just kind of not much else to say. I'm extremely grateful for the fact that this man Yeshua 2,000 years ago laid down principles that we have been able to uncover from his ancient Aramaic language that give us guidelines for kind of put guardrails on the mind for how to keep us on track. Pretty awesome. You had mentioned Ari Rain, and I'm really feeling gratitude for the few minutes we shared with her yesterday, Jeannie, when we watched that video on the body. I've shared with our audience previously that one day we were watching a video. Ari is really into anatomy and physiology, and she wanted to watch a particular video. And in it, all the organs, you know, kind of fall out of a cartoon-shaped body on the ground in order of size, and then each organ sings to you. And when the eyes come up, the eyes sing, "I am your eyes, I am your eyes, I see the world brand new." Now, this is not a conversation I had with Ari at that point, but she turns to me and looks at me and says, "They don't understand, do they, Papa? We don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain." So yesterday we watched, she wanted to watch that video again, so we watched it. And everything went to a whole new level. I mean, she had taken from all of the conversations, and of course she's heard hundreds of hours of the radio show. But she, together, although I'd never said that directly to her, we see with our brain. And what opened yesterday is we were talking about all of the senses and that the eye receives information, light. She started when she wants to transfer information to somebody else. She started to write. She's four, started to write letters to them. And so we had that conversation about light energy comes into the eye, and it's the brain that turns it into what we see. Yesterday, it just went to a whole new level. It was just so much, so amazing to watch her comprehend, because we were talking about smelling something. And I said to her, "Well, you know, the same way that we don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain. We don't smell with our nose. We smell with our brain." And it was just like, you could see the wheels turn. Like, oh. So the nose brings in information, and you know, and she just went right with that. And then it went to the ears, you know, and you know, she repeated it. Well, an example, you know, I say a word, and you think of one thing, and Mimi thinks of another. So it's the brain that's hearing the words; it's not my speaking. And you could just see her swimming in that and rocking that, and it was just awesome to be part of. So I certainly appreciate what she teaches me and how I have to put things in a way that she comprehends and ties it together. And, you know, speaking of the Beatitudes, it's Beatitude number five, or pardon me, number four, is a really amazing piece of work. And as I put it in context with this conversation with Aria yesterday, I realize on a new level that this is the Beatitude that we're working with her on. And so Beatitude number five, according to the Greeks, says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be filled." Now, you look at the traditional approach to life that's presented through Christianity today, and there's righteous indignation and there's righteous anger. And so you know, bless those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and you see people out there doing their righteous thing. But when you get to the Aramaic, it's got nothing to do with that. And I'm appreciating in a new way as I think of this particular beatitude. And it's beatitude number 4. And so it speaks of developing a hunger, hunger and thirst. And there's a cute story about the guru is in the middle of the river, and a student, Achila, comes to him and says, what do I need to do to become enlightened? And the guru grabs him by the scruff of the neck and sticks his head under the water until he's almost making his last jerking kick. He's almost drowned, and he pulls his head up the water. Why did you do that? Why did you almost drown me? Question, and I just gave you the answer. Well, what do you mean? I asked you, how do I get to be enlightened? He said, you notice how much you wanted that next breath? That's how much you've got to want it. I noticed the world's, you know, talked the other day about bread and circuses. The Greeks understood. And if you gave bread and circuses, you gave them entertainment. Today the circus is football and it's soccer and it's hockey and, you know, it's all of that stuff that people can distract themselves with and forget about what's really important. But this is something you've got to want. And this specifically in Aramaic says hunger and thirst. And understanding from the Aramaic how the mind works, and there's nowhere in the culture that I know of, I don't care which of the psychiatrists or which of the schools of philosophy or else what else you're looking at, there's nowhere I know of that takes this piece of information and makes it usable. And what it says, you've got to hunger for the mind structure. So you're building a structure into your mind, and recognize this as you work with this work. You're building a structure that moves in 3 different arenas. It's a structure that will give you an attitude. It will give you judgment. And it will give you behavior. So in order to get what you want, in order to get the kind of judgment that you want, the ability to assess things, and the ability to have a particular behavior, you've got to have a mind structure that can output that, that can prompt you toward that. So this particular beatitude is saying, you really need to hunger for this structure. And, of course, part of hungering for it is you're going to have to understand it and take responsibility for building it into your mind so that your mind can output a particularly important, I can't really say piece of data, a particularly important gestalt. You're familiar with the German word gestalt. It's something that's whole. So conscious that in order to have this attribute we're going to talk about in a minute that you want, that's referred to in this beatitude, you're going to have to know how to build a structure into your mind to achieve it. And to do that, you're going to have to want it enough to work for it, to do the work that's required. And the mind structure that it's talking about, and remember the word discipline in our culture has been translated or has been interpreted by many as, you know, properly beat up, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. And discipline becomes a form of abuse. But the word actually comes from disciple, which means properly taught. If you don't know how your mind works, and you know how to build into it a structure to give you the output that you as a conscious spiritual being want from it, then it's not going to be able to give that to you. So for me, I've got a whole new appreciation looking at it in the context of Thanksgiving. I've got a whole new appreciation for this particular beatitude And the fact that Aria gave us the experience with her yesterday of participating in her building into her mind a structure to comprehend and understand. And she asked the appropriate questions for, she's comprehending it. Information comes in the eyes. Information comes in the nose. Information comes in the ears. Information comes in the taste. We used to make another example. There's some things. The other day, one of the things that Jeannie had found at the grocery store was a vegetarian sausage rolled up in a pancake. And it was just 2 or 3 days ago. And Arya's wanting to dip it in maple syrup. I said, no. Sausage, it goes with mustard. And so I dip mine in mustard. And she's like, ooh, mustard. I said, sausage with maple syrup. So we just had this conversation playfully. But I was able to speak to her about, notice that information comes in the mouth. And the information that went in my mouth, my brain interpreted it, turned into something wonderful, mustard on a sausage pancake. Your brain went, no way. And your brain took in maple syrup. So notice that what is in the world isn't what is. It's how our mind interprets it makes it important. And we have to train our mind to make what's important to us important to it so that it outputs a proper foundation, proper data to support us going where we're going as spiritual beings. So this beatitude, properly translated from the Aramaic, would be read like this. Of course, each of the Beatitudes starts out with blessed are they, according to the Greeks. It doesn't say that. But what it says is a latent neural structure implanted by the Creator guides happiness and well-being, becomes your conscious possession. You who hunger for mind structure underlying the attitude, judgment, and behavior described as just and fair behavior between people. And then there's the reward of it. What it says is you will attain it. So you will have a mind that instead of, if in your history there's, the way our family makes it is we steal from people. Well, the mind structure is one of, in order to make it, the mind prompts somebody to steal. Or, whatever it is. But understanding that if your mind does not support you having just and fair behavior as a natural thing, then you're going to have to dismantle what your mind, if this makes sense to you and it's something that you want, you're going to have to dismantle what your mind does prompt you to in terms of behavior with others and then consciously, purposely build into it. Forgive everything unlike this and consciously, purposely build into it just and fair behavior. Now, of course, many people say, but there's so much unfairness in the world. Well, that's true. Yep. Everybody's been ripped off all kinds of times. But that's not relative. What's relative is what do you want in the way of a mind structure to support the way you live? Are you going to be in harmony? Are you going to live in harmony with the way your true being is designed to express? Or are the mind structures that underlie your behavior in terms of others going to simply follow the genetic and family patterns of the past? Just and fair behavior as a mind structure. So that your perceptual mind, when it's called into activity, can serve up behavior prompts that will guide you to justice and fairness with others. And when we can get enough people on planet Earth, Yeshua said a little leavening leavens the whole loaf. He wasn't talking about bread. He talked about critical mass in physics. When we get a critical mass of people, we have this mind structure that underlies just and fair behavior. functioning out of that Justin Fair behavior, then the energy field of Justin Fair behavior between men will become so strong that it will induce, literally through induction, an energy principle called induction, induce every mind on the planet to automatically shift into Justin Fair behavior, and it'll happen in an instant, that critical mass. And Patrick will say, Michael, why do you give an opportunity? Why do you do the workshop for two or three people? Because critical mass is the key, and I don't know which mind is going to be the one that carries us through. Who's going to be that next drop? Changes the whole game for everybody. So we appreciate you and are in deep thanks and appreciation, and send our blessings for you to have an awesome and a safe, healthy, and happy holy day season for these next, and that this new year coming up becomes the best year yet of your eternal life. Blessings. Thanks for joining us today.
Next one is classically translated as, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And it oftentimes harkens back into that, you know, well, I'll be big about it, I'll be merciful. But in Aramaic, it says, you who have rachma. And, you know, I can remember back in the day when we were working on understanding this word rachma, the live work was going on of what does this mean. And we actually did some, I was traveling with the manuscript, getting digital imaging, looking to get high-res digital images done on it. I was out in California, and we connected with a community of Native American speakers. Actually took the manuscript to one of their services, and one of them got up and read it, you know, just like it was, you know, like they were reading something in English. It was pretty cool to be part of that, and we were asking people who were Native Aramaic speakers, still a very live language, what this word rachma meant. And the response we got was, we don't know. The meaning has been lost. And the most profound thing that they could say about the word rachma was, we don't know what it means, but our tradition says it's the most precious jewel you could have. And it related to, related to something like a big diamond ring. It's like really precious stuff. And what we had determined at that point, and it was kind of confirmed by them, but there was no real remembrance of the original meaning of the word, was that rachma was this filter in the frontal lobes of the brain, and medical science is catching up and starting to show, gee, there's a place in the brain where when love is there, it changes behavior, it changes perception, does all kinds of things, just exactly what the Aramaic spoke about. So there's this filter, then when it's connected to active present love, when it's live with love, it shifts everything. And it becomes quite literally a gateway through which our created essence, love, shows up in physiology. And the way that I've developed over the years to bring people to that experience is simply to invite them to think about the first time they held a newborn child. And for people who've had that experience, to just go back and remember holding the newborn and tap into the essence of the newborn. And virtually everybody that we've asked that question of, and we've done it all over the globe, different countries, different cultures, different languages, hold the newborn, and everybody comes back with, first of all, it's usually a smile. Even people who they kind of look like they're living a pretty miserable existence, if they'll just take a moment and tap into the moment where they held that newborn child. And it may be a child that, it was 25 years ago, and they're angry at the child, and the child's misbehaving, and it's done all kinds of things. But when they stop and they tap in, there's a breath and a sweetness that comes into them. And they use words based in love, variations on the theme of love, to describe that newborn. And then I'll ask people, so is the newborn loving you, or is the newborn love? And it just becomes so obvious to everyone. It's like, no, they're not doing love. It's who they are. And when I realized that's who I am, you know, yesterday we talked about, I just, after the show the other day when you were on with me, I was listening to an historian who came up with a thing called the Mr. Magoo hypothesis. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't think so, unless I heard it from you, but don't remember it.
Okay. Well, actually, I just came in touch with it the other day, so it's not something I've ever talked of before. But do you remember the cartoon character, Mr. Magoo?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Do you remember anything about the cartoons, what they really were, what happened in them?
I do not.
I remember watching them, but I didn't have any real recollection. It's been a long time. But this historian goes on to explain why he came up with this thesis called the Mr. Magoo hypothesis, and that is that Mr. Magoo was this character who was so nearsighted, he had never had any idea where he was. But he had an expectation of where he was and what he was doing and who he was in that space. And he behaved as though his expectations in that space were true about where he was. And it never matched. You know, he was walking through the world. You know, he walks through a lion's den and he thinks he's at the zoo. And, you know, and it just unfolded. I mean, it's such a perfect metaphor for people who've forgotten that they are literally conscious, active, present love. They think they're rage or fear or pain or trauma or drama, and they're walking through the world as though they are this rage or fear, and they're in this space that's designed for active, present love, but their mind's whole construct is that of something that makes their belief about themselves foolish. I went back after listening to him. This was just the other day that I came across this historian's presentation and watched a couple of the cartoons. It was like, oh, I'd forgotten. I maybe never even realized that that's what it was. It was just kind of this goofy thing. But when you see it, it's worth getting on YouTube and just Googling YouTubing one or two Mr. Magoo cartoons, because he's literally thinks he's in one place and he's in another, and it creates such ridiculous circumstances. And this, to me, is how this presence of Rachma is how we undo the Mr. Magoo in ourselves.
Mm.
Because we open the gateway for the truth about who we are to enter into, to flood into physiology and into the experience of the moment. And rather than acting as the ridiculous self that, you know, our early traumatic experiences or our genes told us we were, we start to function as we truly are, and we show up in the world as truth, and then we get to interact honestly in the world. And the result that 2,000 years ago Yeshua offered of this is that when you open this gateway that brings literally active present love into this form, you know, when we look at someone at what we call a human so-called body, there's no reason to believe there's any human life there unless love is present and active in that form. It's just a human-looking form. But opening this literal gateway, one, it brings... It's a space through which love shows up in our physiology and starts to fuel everything. And two, the mind itself is kept on track through the presence of intentions, which are the raw material of goals. The mind is kept on track with love rather than getting lost in hostility or fear. And so the result that Yeshua promised with this one was, you'll receive it. They'll end up living as the presence of love, and the Mr. Magoo experience will be gone. Now, I don't think that part was actually in the scriptures 2,000 years ago, but it kind of is a great metaphor for us functioning out of something that we're not.
Certainly is, and you have such a good articulation of Rachma, so I'm going to just leave that where it's at, and it's really, really well done. And for what I'll share on Beatitude 5 is I'll just share kind of an example of a lived experience of how this showed up for me. Just, I mean, it showed up many, many times, but just how it showed up in this particular one. Because one of the things that begins to happen as we do Beatitudes 1, 2, 3, and 4, and that repeats, and I see this as kind of a roadmap that, okay, well, Beatitude 5 is really saying that if we keep doing this, we're going to get to this restored state, like this restoration with, you know, the Rachma. And one of the things that I envision is that as we fill up, you know, because remember, I was learning these and really practicing them in earnest and continue to, but I saw the contrast so distinctly as I was going through 2011 to 2015 with the whole mental health stuff. And I would say for a while I became really selfish, and I've used the word divinely selfish. I don't know if I heard that from you or Rex, but that's a word that I heard from somebody. And I had always thought, well, that was selfish in a bad way. And in this work, I realized, well, the divine selfishness is actually needed for the restoration of who it is we really are, to shed, you know, anything that's out of alignment with that pure state.
The place I've come with that word of selfish is a shift in the language to it's a state of being self-wise as opposed to selfish.
Yeah.
There's a transition word that, oh, I do it from that state of being, and it's always on track with love and therefore always self-wise and will serve all of life at the same time. Because I've got that earlier beatitude where just and fair behavior is the underlying construct in my mind that directs all of my behavior.
Well, and that aligns with this one really well too, because as we fill up, think of a cup that's empty, you know, and if we blocked out or resisted this pure state, then we're essentially denying, you know, the true nature of who we are. And so as that restoration starts to happen, I think of the cup kind of filling up, and then at the top of the cup it overflows. Well, if it overflows, then there's lots that can be given. And so we could just let it overflow and drop to the ground, or we can put it out there in the world. And the story I'm going to share here is from Starbucks. I was actually using Starbucks as my office away from home at the time, and I would go there and write and do whatever work I was doing. And one day I was sitting there, and this thought came up to go get a chocolate chip cookie. And I didn't particularly have an inclination that, you know, it wasn't what would typically be there for me would be craving something, right? It's like that was out. It was just the thought was go get a chocolate chip cookie. So I go up and
sounds like divine
and I'm looking
guidance.
Around. Yes, this divine guidance comes. So I'm in line thinking, okay, well, and I order the chocolate chip cookie, and the person, the barista, says, you know, would you like that warmed up? I said, sure. Could you put it on a plate? Because instead of the bag, and they said, sure. So they come back with this chocolate chip cookie that's all warmed up. And as I turn, that same inner voice says, well, actually, my eyes are directed to a woman. I actually paused in the Starbucks, and I look over, and there's a woman there, and the voice says, go give it to that woman. And like, okay, this is really strange, right? This is not in my comfort zone at all. And so I did it. I went over and I said, hey, I bought this chocolate chip cookie, you know, and I'd like to give it to you. And she looked up, and you would have thought she won the lottery or something in terms of her demeanor. She's like, really? She's like, thank you. Like, I really needed that today. And And actually, she said, I really needed that today later, so I messed up the story a little bit. But she was just, thank you, and appreciated it, and et cetera. So I went back and worked for a couple hours, and she packed up, and she was walking out. And I didn't notice, but she caught my attention and said, hey, I just want you to know that I really needed that today, and I genuinely appreciate what you did. I don't know what that woman was going through, but that was an insight I had of this overflowing from kind of the true heart center right? That true Rachma love overflowing out into the world. And where the first four Beatitudes to me have, and I know I'm going just from the lived experience of them, to me felt more like, not that they didn't affect other people, but more like it was like me trying to navigate, like, who am I and what is it that is happening here? And so as that restoration started to happen, then it became more clear. It's like, okay, this is to be put out. This is to be shared. This is to allow for that energy, that love to be brought to the world.
You know, over
and,
the years, people
and of course, to finish where it says, you know, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And I know that word's Rachma. It's like I received then this immense love restored in me again. It was almost like a reverberation of, wow, I didn't even do a big thing to me. I just bought a cookie, right? But when she said that it was so meaningful for her, it was almost like it filled me up. So I don't know if the metaphor would continue this way, but it's almost like my cup got bigger, right?
I'm with you. I mean, that's exactly what he says the result will be. You know, if you open this thing called Rachma and your judgment and behavior are fueled by the presence of love, what it says is you'll receive it. So it sounds like, you know, as you gave it, you received it, and then it came back double. That's precisely the principle he's talking about here. So right on track.
And I want to encourage people, if they're going to practice these, it's like, again, just like we talked about a couple of days ago, you know, there's a patience, you know, being gentle and patient and starting with where you're at and letting that be okay, you know. But what these promises are, these aren't like, you know, something that you have to rush into. This is something that it's going to happen. If you do these things, promises, you will receive them. You will receive the fruits of these work, of these practices.
Well, that's the, you know, that principle in step 7 in the reality management worksheet is, I give something away, I get the original, they get the carbon copy. And even if they're not home for delivery, I've already received it. In this case, that woman was home for delivery, and it obviously filled her to overflowing, and she was able to once again return it to you and who knows who else. It's that expansion principle. And interesting, in the Aramaic, if we take the phrase that was, the kingdom of heaven is within you, the word that is translated as heaven is the kingdom of expansion. It's within you. It's like when you allow this energy to move through you, when you let that gateway open.
Nice.
Everything
like
shifts.
That.
And we're fueled, literally fueled by that which this human device is designed to be fueled by. You know, I'll oftentimes ask people the question, you know, have you got a device in your home or your office or your car or your shop that works really well when you unplug it from its power supply? Everybody says, well, of course not. What makes you think that your human form could possibly function properly if you unplug it from love? It's power supply. And there's a gateway, Rachma, that was understood. It's looking more and more, according to research, like it's what's called, part of the brain that's called the angular gyrus. And that's where that the whole system is changed by the presence of love in that part of the brain.
I have a question for you, and one of the things I think you said, and I may not have heard you correctly, but you had mentioned this idea of the kingdom of heaven being expansion, right?
Right.
I heard you
right. Yes.
And I've mm-hmm. also heard you explain the kingdom of heaven as a community of love. And so can you talk to that? Is that the same thing? Just a different way of expressing?
To me, it would be the same thing. It would be,
okay.
What I heard you describing in your beautiful chocolate chip analogy or story is exactly that. So you had an inclination that came through Rachma. You fulfilled that inclination and you handed it off, which expanded the presence of love, obviously, for this woman, who in turn, fueled by love, returned the energy to you and expanded it still further. And what came out of that? Like, you know, if you guys happen to be back in that store tomorrow and that woman was sitting at that table and you looked at each other, what would you be living in? The community of love. It's expanded,
right,
and it's eternal when we choose to go there. And the internal benefit, and this is, again, where we receive it, is we're plugging our physiology back into the energy source that it was always designed to work from. It was never, and it will never function from rage or guilt or grief or hate or vengeance or sadness or greed. It will never function from any of that. The only result will become, will people will walk into more drama and trauma, or literally find themselves in their own hells. It was interesting. There's a Netflix series that Jeannie and I watched not too long ago called Lucifer. And
sure,
the devil, have you seen it?
I have. I've seen, I think, maybe three of the series.
Well, it's pretty interesting. Well, in one of the later seasons, you know, and for those who are listening who are not familiar with it, and there's some pretty good stuff that happens in it, but, you know, Satan is in hell and decides he wants to go on vacation, so he goes, moves to L.A. And he decides he likes L.A., so he's going to stay there. But there's a point, and it's so right on. In fact, you know, they stopped after six seasons, and I've actually got it in my notes. I've made some notes and plan to communicate with the developers of it, because they left it at such a perfect place to bring actual forgiveness to the world. But if you remember, you know, the devil, Satan, Lucifer, has this power, and his power is he gets close to people, captures their gaze, looks into their eyes, and asks them, what do you really want? And the only thing they can do, I mean, they literally go into an altered state, and they tell them what their true goal is. And it's right on with forgiveness, so right on. But in one of the last, I don't remember exactly which one, maybe three or four from the end of season six, is he expresses how his job as Satan was to find out those deepest desires, their goals, and make sure they weren't fulfilled.
Oh.
And there's the core of forgiveness. That, you know, whenever, and it's so backward to virtually everybody when they first say, wait a minute, why would I cancel this perfectly good goal for somebody to cherish and honor me? That's stupid. Well, you're right. It's a perfectly good goal, and you would never cancel because there's something wrong with it. But if you load it into your mind and it resonates in you some form of hostility or fear, you're now living in your own hell. What's Satan's job? To make sure you stay living there. And in Aramaic, the word Satan means the resister, one who misleads. And you watch the average person when you ask them to be responsible for their rage, their fear, their guilt, their insanity, whatever it is, what do they do? Oh, no, no, that's not true. They go into resistance, and then they tell you their mind's lie, their story about how it's somebody else's fault. The resistor, one who misleads, precisely Satan. So at some point, I'm planning on communicating with the producers of that and inviting them into and handing them off the technology of forgiveness, because they've set the stage literally for Lucifer to deliver actual forgiveness to the world, which I think would be just like the epitome of redundancy.
That'd be a clever twist.
Well, you know, I was so shocked, you know, and it doesn't show up until, I think it was maybe halfway or more through the last season of it, that he just kind of slipped. And if he didn't have the brain cells, it would just go by. Most people wouldn't recognize it as meaning anything. But he's like, oh, my job is Satan, just to know your deepest desire and make sure it never happens. And it's just a perfect setup for season seven, for him to come back and say, okay, now I'm going to do the big reveal. Here it is. and to hand people that, you know, the next power, you know, there are other characters in the that are other divine creatures, and they each have a power. Well, I can see where season 7 would be the power that this new iteration of Lucifer has, is the ability to inspire people to cancel the goals, collapse the perception that their pain is based in, and clean up carbon-based memory. It would just be like a perfect seventh season to close it out and deliver forgiveness to the world.
Well, I support you in making that connection, because that would be quite wonderful for them to have that information and tie it in.
Yeah, it would be so perfect. So hold space for that one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Then let's look at the next beatitude, which is historically interpreted as blessed are the pure in heart, for they,
yeah,
shall,
for they shall see God.
See God. And in Aramaic, it speaks of you who have, and the word in Aramaic is dadsian, you who have a completely purified mind. In other words, you got to go in and clean up carbon-based memory. You know, the other day we talked about perception is a construct of the mind, and if everything comes from carbon-based memory, you know, these constructs, then we have, and there are unresolved issues, then whatever perceptions our mind generates, those perceptions are going to be totally and completely false about the actuality of the world. They'll only be true about us. As we do our work, you clean out carbon-based memory so that everything based in the lie, anything based in hostility or fear, is removed from the structure. And then we've got a database, this multi-generational database called carbon-based memory, that has only accurate information in it. And when it has accurate information in it, then everything it presents about the actuality is accurate. There are no lies left in it. But it's still not the truth, even though everything it holds is true, because it's not a live present moment experience as we're designed to have. It's still replicating something from the past. So we go from errant perception, but that's still death. But when we've cleaned up the database, then that becomes the stepping stone for, well, we've acquired the habit of collapsing carbon-based memories constructs. So now what do we have? We have a clean and open space within the mind. That 9-bit space is open, and now the creator's mind can write enlightened perception. We can gather directly from the actuality a live present moment experience that is truly filled with the active presence of love and the true experience that we're designed for with life. So we go from errant perception to corrected perception to enlightened perception. And so this beatitude says exactly that. You who have a completely purified mind, and what it says is that at that moment, you're now going to comprehend or come into direct relationship with Allaha, the creator, the invisible source of creation. It's like they talk in the scriptures about the mind of man is not yet conceived of what lies in store. The mind of man can't do that. But when we clean carbon-based memory up, Adamos, the red clay, then we can become an instrument that enters into full relationship with love. And it's just so profoundly powerful, considering, you know, the alternative of fulfilling all the goals of the non-being mind.
Well said, well said. And I know we don't have too many more minutes here. And so I don't want to repeat everything you said because it was so well said. Another way that I really like the way that J.M. also said it with his interpretation, he says, where it says, blessed are the pure of heart, he wrote, wise are they who are consistently restored in this way. which is reflective of that pure heart. And rather than for they shall see God, like flashes of lightning, God will increasingly reveal itself in the depth of their soul. And that reflects what you were saying, I believe, in terms of that corrected perception of things and that enlightened perception of it, getting to that place where there's this. And my word for it, which was a difficult word, honestly, for me to kind of come into contact with, because most of my life I felt like I didn't know anything, you know, that I was a little bit lost. I mentioned last time the idea of the duck with the, you know, feet paddling underwater and a lot of insecurity. And as my work with this started to come into a place where that purity of heart really took more hold, there was a knowing that was from that connected place, from that source, you know, holy, pure space. And I'll share one of the examples of how that started to show up for me. Because I had a lot of issues with money, I'm going to use a money example. You know, I had a lot of fear of money. I put a lot of energy into money, and in my early days, you know, put money above a lot of things. So it was interesting because in some of my work with this, as my heart began to purify, there would be this clarity of what was going to happen with whether it's the stock market or, you know, something. And I remember several times where I was given insights of, you know, hey, here's an insight of what's going to take place. But I didn't believe it. You know, I was still in this, well, I am unable to know, right? So I would doubt it. And then it would happen. I'm like, well, that's interesting. And there was this, for me, kind of a restoration over time into trusting more and more and more and more and more and more and more. And the more I trusted, the more I was able to act in a way that was consistently in alignment. Now, I'm not perfect, of course, in terms of doing that, but there's an element of contrast of how I had been to how I am today. And there is a clear knowing, and I know you know this because you will, you know, call people out of the blue sometimes, right, to them, and you just call. And I remember when you used to do that with me, it's like, wow, how did he know? Not that you necessarily had the full information of why that call was important before you called, but you trusted the divine spark that in the pure space. You trusted that and acted. So that
back
trust
to the first beatitude.
Expands. Yes.
And exactly what you just said is back to the first beatitude. Are you living in the eternal forces that will incline you toward behavior and follow through with that behavior?
Yes, and this right becomes more, Beatitude 6 becomes more, it's like, hey, that deepens, that becomes, there's this wisdom that starts to come forth that is more and more in someone's life as they continue to practice these things, comes into their life more and more with a trust that is way beyond, for me, a trust that I had ever experienced in my life with anything. I had misplaced trust. I had different ideas of what trust was, but this became a pure trust in this divine source.
Trust Rukka. Back to that eternal force that was designed for us to incline us toward the highest behaviors possible